for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Massachusetts voters seem to be sending a message yesterday. They're sending Republican Scott Brown to Washington to fill the Senate seat left vacant after Democrat Ted Kennedy's death last August. Joining me to talk about what Scott Brown's election could mean for Massachusetts and the Obama administration, Peter Baker with the New York Times, Chris Deliza, author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, and Peter Walston of The Wall Street Journal. I do look forward to hearing your questions and comments. You can join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a tweet or reach us through Facebook. Joining us first by phone from Boston, Matt Visor. He's political reporter in the State House Bureau of the Boston Globe. Good morning to you, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Good to be here.
You wrote this was a stunning come-from-behind victory. Why did Scott Brown appeal so much to voters?
He really tapped into a lot of the anger economically up here that's around Massachusetts and around the country. He also ran on health care, which struck a lot of people up here and really attracted a lot of attention and very rapidly. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, this was seen as highly unlikely. Martha Coakley had all the advantages going in, and Scott Brown just caught fire and caught fire late and never let go and caught a lot of national attention.
So was it her loss or his win?
I think it's probably a combination of the two. I mean, he ran an extraordinary campaign, and she made a lot of missteps and just about every misstep that you could almost down the line toward the end of the campaign.
You know, he specifically ran against the health care overhaul legislation, and that's so interesting, coming from a state in which health care is provided to all. Explain that to us.
Scott Brown, his arguments did not get into so much of the policy. He argued it almost strictly from an economic perspective and a parochial perspective, saying that Massachusetts already has health care. Other states should do the same thing as Massachusetts. We shouldn't be paying for Nebraska's health care. And, you know, it's sort of a direct shot at Ben Nelson and sort of some of the agreements that were made in Washington to get health care through. And that message seemed to resonate here down the stretch. And Martha Coakley did not do a very effective job at arguing the Democratic perspective of why we should have health care for everybody across the country and why that could lower costs for Massachusetts.
So how do the positions he staked out during the campaign align with or square with the overall Republican agenda?
I think that he particularly on terrorism, he ran a lot on terror, and that worked effectively, particularly after Christmas Day, when that became more on the minds of people here. Taxes is another thing. He ran on an anti-tax platform, which squares with the national Republicans. He's probably maybe a little bit more socially moderate, although he was endorsed by some pro-life groups, although he says that he supports Roe v. Wade himself.
So he does support some abortion rights, but we're not totally clear on what it is he does not support?
He has a little bit of a muddied position, and Martha Coakley tried to exploit that down the road, especially using some legislation that he sponsored at the State House that would have limited emergency contraceptives in the case of rape victims.
How has his behavior in the State House been received by his colleagues?
It's been interesting because, at least at the state house and probably in Massachusetts politics as a whole, Republicans have not had a huge voice. There's only five Republicans in the 40-member state Senate. He's been one of those five, and for all intents and purposes, the 35 Democrats don't need the five Republicans. So it's awfully hard to be an effective Republican in the state house. And so he sponsored legislation, but there's not sort of one signature thing that he's been able to point to in terms of a legislative accomplishment.
But why then was he put forward as the candidate to beat Martha Coakley?
Part of it is his background in the National Guard. He's an attractive man. He's an attractive candidate. He's somebody who had been seen as a rising star in the Republican Party and was put up to run against Martha Coakley, largely to get his name out there and maybe pave the way for future office. I don't think even Republicans, when this started, thought that Scott Brown could ever defeat Martha Coakley. It was more of a sense like Mitt Romney running against Ted Kennedy in 1994, running a good race and setting himself up for office later down the road.
So would you, having covered the state house, expect to see big things from Scott Brown?
It's hard to tell. I mean, he was an extraordinarily effective campaigner, but we don't know as much about sort of once he has all this national attention and he goes to Washington now with a little bit of a mandate to do some things for Massachusetts. It's really hard to tell if he'll also grow into that role the way that he grew week by week and throughout the campaign. I mean, there's certainly a lot of expectations now among Republicans, and you know, there's even talk up here, you know, that later down the road he could be a vice presidential candidate, the way we in Massachusetts like to sort of prop our politicians up on a national stage. So it'll be interesting to see.
Matt Visery, he's political reporter in the State House Bureau of the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Eliza, what is your sense of how quickly Scott Brown is likely to be seated?
You know, Diane, I think there was a lot of back and forth about this idea that potentially the seating would be delayed in order to get a health care vote through. I think you saw very quickly that come to an end with one statement that was put out last night by Jim Webb, a Democrat from Virginia, essentially saying Scott Brown should be seated. We should not proceed on any future health care votes until he is seated. It seems to me, and I think for people who follow the political process, especially Congress pretty closely, there was never a sense that they were going to be able to sort of delay this. Oh, well, we got a few absentees we still haven't counted up there in Waltham. You know, it was never going to be something from a political perspective that if a Republican won Ted Kennedy's seat, that they would be able to sort of delay this thing so that they could pass health care. It's just not politically tenable when you've just lost a Senate election in the most Democratic state in the country.
Chris Eliza, he's author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. Peter Baker, there are a number of lessons here for Democrats. What do you see as some of these?
Well, as you say, there are a lot of lessons. I mean, one is that the delay in getting health care through has been costly now for this White House. They had originally intended to have health care pass out of both houses by the August recess and then out of a final bill to the president's desk and sign by the end of the year. Then they moved into perhaps before the State of the Union. This shows that the delay has not helped. And all of the sausage making that has dominated the coverage of this has clearly turned off at least a certain percentage of the American electorate that sees it as sort of unseemly or has focused on the negative aspects of it, the deal making or the cost or what have you. So that's one big lesson, obviously. Another lesson is that the mood changes fast. A year ago today, President Obama was inaugurated on the Mall of Washington, D.C., and it was a new era for progressives who thought this was the beginning of something special. Here we are a year later, and suddenly all that feels gone.
And that was the voice of Peter Baker with The New York Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Peter Walston, the Wall Street Journal. Was this a vote against President Obama?
In some ways, it was, and perhaps more importantly, putting aside the unique factors that affected the race in Massachusetts, what matters now is how it's perceived around the country, what it means for the midterm elections this year, which are turning out to be pretty dismal, at least the way it looks right now for Democrats, and how everybody responds, both parties. We have some new polling data out this morning that shows that what happened in Massachusetts is happening nationally, which is the movement of independent voters away from the Democrats and back to the Republicans. Obama won 52% of independent voters, we saw in exit polls in 2008. Now, according to our poll, his approval rating among independents is 41%. That's really, really low. Now, independents don't really love either party. This is not necessarily a boon for the Republicans. It could change depending on what happens with the economy. But I think Democrats have now realized that they need to probably do something about that that exodus of independent voters. If they're going to win in competitive races, they've got governor's races in Ohio and Florida. They've got Senate races in Colorado and a governor's race in Colorado. These are states that are that independent voters are very important, and they also happen to be states that are important to the president's own reelection campaign in 2012.
Peter Walston of the Wall Street Journal. Also here in the studio, Chris Eliza of WashingtonPost.com, Peter Baker of the New York Times. I look forward to hearing your reactions to the election of a Republican, Scott Brown, in Massachusetts. And we're back with three analysts, Peter Baker of the New York Times, Chris Eliza of WashingtonPost.com, Peter Walston of the Wall Street Journal. Here's an email from Steve in Baltimore. He says, please help me understand. On the one hand, I heard Scott Brown's election is a signal to the Democratic Party that voters are fed up with the sweetheart deal going to Wall Street. On the other hand, I heard Scott Brown's election will mean President Obama will have to drop plans for the financial crisis responsibility fee. If voters are upset about Wall Street, then I would think they would want the fee doubled, not killed. I'd like to hear Peter Walston's comments.
Well, that's a series of good questions. But the way the politics is shaping up right now, and we talked about lessons learned for the Democrats, they think the lesson is that they need to be more populist. They need to find a way to appeal to people and tap into the anger. And we saw just a few days before this election, the president come out and propose the tax on big banks. And then immediately Martha Coakley seized on it, and all of the Democrats. You could see it happening in other campaigns around the country, that the Democrats immediately started talking about the bank tax and trying to get Republicans to oppose it. So there's obviously been a decision made within the leadership of the Democratic Party that this is going to be a signature issue for them now going forward. Republicans will tell you that, you know, that's easy for them. They can paint Democrats as just trying to raise taxes again, and that this doesn't create jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this will be one of the debates we see playing out. Whether it works or not, it's certainly a great question.
Here's an email from Monica in Oldenburg, Indiana. She says, John Stewart had a very funny, very biting take on the Democrats Monday night. He pointed out that President Bush never had a filibuster-proof 60 votes, but nevertheless got everything he wanted. The Democrats, what's wrong with them? They appear to be so timid and hapless. Why can't they accomplish anything? Chris?
Well, I think it's in some ways the problem of large majorities, Diane. You know, I think you look at the numbers and you see 59 seats today in the Senate, 256 seats in the House. These are broader majorities than Democrats have enjoyed in modern memory, and they're broader majorities than Republicans enjoyed when they were in control. The problem with that is that it's a broad majority. It means that you have voices on the left, voices in the center, and voices on the right. As a result, what you've seen, Peter Baker mentioned this earlier, the process element of the health care bill, for example, is a perfect example. You have people like Joe Lieberman, who caucuses with Democrats, who they need to get the bill on the floor, essentially saying, I don't want a public option. You have Ben Nelson saying from Nebraska saying, I don't want this abortion language in there. Because it's a broad caucus, because they now need to get bills, 60 votes to get them on the floor, they are forced to deal and make deals with some people who clearly the liberal base of the party does not approve of. If they had a smaller majority, Howard Dean, I thought, had a very, very interesting comment today. He said it would have been better if we always had 59 seats in the Senate, meaning that they wouldn't have to placate people like Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson, that this will ultimately be better for them legislatively. I'm not sure if I agree with that, but it's clearly a sentiment that is held within the party space.
And here's an email from AQ in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for you, Peter Baker. He says, if Scott Brown really did tap into the anger of people, then how was Martha Coakley up 20 points in December 2009? Did these people simply get angry in the last 3 weeks?
Well, you could argue people do get angrier as time goes on. One thing is, nobody knew who Scott Brown was 3 weeks ago or a month ago. This is a very short campaign. He had to introduce himself to the state in a short order. As we said, Martha Coakley was the state attorney general, won on a statewide ballot, well-known, and the presumed front-runner. When Brown made clear to voters that there was an alternative, that there was somebody else, and when Coakley ran such an obviously flawed campaign, you know, it created an opening for angry people to find a voice.
Now, let me ask the three of you a sexist question. Had a woman posed practically nude on fold-out in Cosmopolitan, what would her political career be like today, Chris?
I feel pretty safe saying, Diane, we would not be calling her Senator-elect fill-in-the-blank. I just think that is the nature of the beast. My mother said to me, why didn't the Scott Brown Cosmo shots get more attention? I didn't have a good answer for her. I think, to Peter Baker's point a moment ago, I think essentially what happened here, the emailer said, how did it go from 20 points to Scott Brown winning? What happened is that all of a sudden this race became only about Martha Coakley, and Scott Brown happened to be the other guy in the race. You know, I think as Matt from the Boston Globe pointed out earlier, we don't know much about Scott Brown. And in truth, I don't think Massachusetts voters know a whole heck of a lot
except
about Scott Brown either.
They do know that Cosmo photo.
They do. And, you know, my guess is, look, there is always a prioritization in voting. Certain things matter more and certain things matter less. What seemed to matter more, and again, we don't have exit polling, unfortunately, so we can't go back and sort of reverse engineer this and figure out exactly what voters were thinking. But what seemed to matter was in 2008, Massachusetts voters voted for change. They did not feel as though the Obama administration had delivered on that change. They also did not feel as though the state government, controlled by Democrats since time immemorial, delivered on that change.
Peter Walston.
Well, on that point, this is another example of where the Democrats did not run a good campaign. Part of what happens in campaigns is it's up to the candidates to create a contrast between themselves and their opponent. The Democrats could have run ads with the Cosmo, with the copy of Cosmo. They could have tried to paint Scott Brown in a certain light. And one of the complaints, now we're hearing a lot of finger pointing from Democrats all over the country now about who screwed up and who's to blame. You hear one consistent point, which is that the Coakley campaign or the National Democrats, none of them really started, quote unquote, going negative on Scott Brown, which unfortunately is one of the realities of campaigns. And when somebody starts surging, you try to do that, and only did it late.
So, Peter Baker, what do we hear about the strategies that Democratic leaders are thinking about at this point?
Well, obviously, if we talk about health care specifically, they have a really difficult choice to make here. There are three options as I see it. One is for the House to simply accept the Senate bill, which many House Democrats have made clear they don't want to do. If the House, the reason that would work is the Senate has passed a bill. If the House simply passed the exact same bill, the exact same language, that's the end of the process. Goes to the president, he signs it, da 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 da. But the House Democrats didn't like the Senate bill, and they don't like the Senate. So the idea of simply accepting what the Senate comes up with is anathema to members of the House of any party at any time. And there are specific things they don't like. But the problem for them is the Senate bill has now become the outer extreme of what the left can get on health care. It's not going to get more liberal. It's only going to get less liberal. So from the left's point of view, I don't know whether they look at it this way, but the Senate bill is now the most – the most they're going to get. If they have to go back to the drawing board, they're going to have to get Senate Republicans, and it's only going to get more centrist, more moderate, more whatever.
Are you suggesting that they might go back to the drawing board starting from scratch and do the whole thing again?
Well, probably not from ultimate scratch, but they're going to have to find ways of drawing over a few Republicans. They're already talking to Senator Snow from Maine. President Obama had a conversation with her on Friday. The numbers aren't there for them.
What about reconciliation?
You know, Diane, I continue to think the idea of reconciliation is one of those things that is floated on the left as a great idea, because why do we need 60 votes? We should be able to pass it. We have 59 senators. Why can't we pass it? The sentiment John Stewart voiced, as you mentioned earlier. That kind of, and I know many people would disagree with this, but the Senate is a place that is ruled by rules. That kind of breach of how things are done, particularly in light of losing, and I cannot stress this enough, losing the most Democratic state in the country, a Senate seat, days ago, I just don't think is politically tenable. One other thing to Peter Baker's point. Many of the calculations, you saw Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, you saw Steny Hoyer, the Majority Leader, a lot of big talk in the run-up last 48 hours before this vote about we're going to get this thing done one way or the other. The ground has shifted significantly with Scott Brown's victory. If you are a moderate Democrat who is considering retirement, who maybe if you weren't even considering retirement, you are going to start thinking very seriously about your political future. Mm. Again, a Republican consultant said to me last night, every Democrat is vulnerable. And, you know, as much as I would like to roll my eyes at that sentiment, sort of that kind of bravado, we're talking about Ted Kennedy's seat in a state that Barack Obama won with 62% of the vote by 800,000 votes in 2008 going to the Republicans.
Peter Walston, does this election mean that President Obama comes out with a very voluble shift to jobs and the economy and sort of lets health care slide?
Well, I think that is still what the White House is trying to figure out. I wish I had an answer for that. What we do know is that the rhetoric in the last week has shifted dramatically to jobs. Some talk of education, maybe a search there for an issue that they can try to that might be a little easier for both sides, and there is some bipartisan agreement on. But Democrats across the board are saying they have to talk about jobs. They have to make that their singular focus. I had a conversation with Governor Jack Markell, who's the chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, and he said for his candidates, that just has to be their absolutely singular focus. You see even Chris Van Hollen, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, saying health care has got to take a back seat in terms of issues that candidates are talking about. It still feels, despite the ground shifting, as Chris said, it still almost feels unimaginable that they would drop health care.
It would be unthinkable. Crippling thing for a White House to have lost its singular, most important, highest priority legislation. It would be crippling because the liberals would lose faith. The base would be in an uproar. The centrists and independents who thought Obama was going to do something would look at a weakened president who can't impose his will on a city that's still Democratic.
How did we get here? Sort of looking back a little bit. You talked about the fact that during the presidential election, President Obama won with 800,000 majority. The question then becomes, did Republicans have a stronger message, a stronger voice? We're going to stop him. We're going to kill him. We're going to stop his legislative agenda. And did that resonate more strongly? Is that how it happened?
You know, Dan, I don't think that Scott Brown ran against President Obama. If you look at any polling, and there was so much polling done in this race, any of the polls that I saw, the president remained personally popular. And that's been borne out in national polling as well. Scott Brown ran against the idea that Democrats were simply – that this was simply their seat. I think the turning point in the race was in a debate. He said, this isn't Ted Kennedy's seat. This isn't the Democratic Party seat. This is the people's seat. Well, that was a very smart thing to say, running against the establishment, but not against the sitting president per se, more against his policies.
Chris, WashingtonPost.com, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's a caller in Newton, New Jersey. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm frightened by this because I look at it as, you know, a campaign that was supported heavily by the birthers and the Tea Party people and the people with expectations that, you know, you snap your fingers and 8 years of destruction is wiped clean and fixed up in 2 seconds. Republicans ran for 8 years running two wars without taxes, stripped the government dry of money, and all of a sudden they expect everything to turn around in a day and a half. It's amazing, you know. Now, if this birthers and the Tea Party people are going to and the climate deniers, it just scares the hell out of me.
Chris.
That's my statement.
Okay. Thanks
just,
for calling.
Just very quickly, I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Was the Tea Party movement and involved in helping to rally the base of the Republican Party for Scott Brown? Absolutely. Is the base of the Republican Party, if every single registered Republican in Massachusetts voted for Scott Brown, enough for him to win? Absolutely not. I think it is a mistake by Democrats to read this as simply he took over the Tea Party movement somehow won this race for him. Scott Brown won this race because independents went with him. The idea of a guy who's going to run against Washington, who is going there to shake up the status quo. It's a message that has a lot of echoes in someone that we all know quite well, a guy named President Barack Obama.
Peter Walston.
Just to add to that point, you know, there were some polling late in the race. We don't have exit polls, as Chris mentioned. There was some polling late in the race, though, that when Scott Brown was surging ahead, you could see that a big proportion of his support was coming from people who feel favorably, personally favorably, toward Barack Obama. So these aren't necessarily birthers or Tea Partiers per se. These are people who like Barack Obama but feel frustrated at the direction of the country and feel frustrated that the government, no matter who's in charge, isn't addressing the problem.
Peter Baker.
Having said that, though, when the White House is there and argues that, well, this isn't about us, he didn't run an ad on Obama. I mean, I agree with what both Chris and Peter said, absolutely. But when the White House makes this argument, it has nothing to do with us, it's sort of a silly argument that they can't win. It reminds me when Karl Rove in 2006 came out after the midterm elections and said that the congressional victory of Democrats really wasn't about President Bush or Iraq. It was about congressional Republican corruption. And he had some numbers and he had a fair point to make. But it just didn't matter. This is what will be the result. The result will be that President Obama's agenda will now have to be drastically rethought.
Chris, you mentioned there were no exit polls. How come?
Well, you know, Diane, the exit polls have to be funded by someone, typically the networks and because it is a testament to how quickly this race developed that, you know, a month ago, the idea of the media, which, as some of your listeners may know, is not flourishing financially. I'm trying to put it in the nicest terms possible. The idea of funding a costly exit poll in a race that we all expected was going to be an easy Democratic win was not particularly appealing, though we all wish we had done so now.
Chris Eliza is author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. We'll take a short break. More of your calls when we come back. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The FDA issues a warning about a chemical often found in baby bottles and food containers. Two Canadian environmentalists describe what their own experiments reveal about BPA and other chemicals used in everyday foods and products. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about Scott Brown's dramatic win in Massachusetts yesterday, the defeat of Martha Coakley by a rather substantial margin, here's an email from Jeff, who says, as a Republican in Indiana who voted for Obama, I am underwhelmed by the change that was promised. I'm to the point where I'm totally tired of both parties and the actions I see versus the words they speak. I'm no longer a Republican or a Democrat. Peter Walston.
Well, that's an interesting point, and it goes to a larger point that Republicans are going to be celebrating this morning and talking about this as a big victory. But this also shows some problems for them. Let's not forget that the Republicans have a kind of a civil war going on within their own party. I think that this defeat by Coakley is going to start a lot of fighting within the Democratic Party, too, about what to do. But the Republicans have a lot of primaries going on, a few high-profile ones, including in Florida, where Governor Charlie Crist, who was the kind of establishment choice of Republican leaders to be the nominee for Senate in that state, is being challenged strongly from the right by Marco Rubio, who's getting support from the conservative movement, the Club for Growth. That's happening in states across the country. And what this election really shows, independent voters upset at the establishment. It's problems for Democrats. It's also possibly problems for the Republican Party. They're still trying to figure out how to deal with that in their own ranks. And our polling, the Wall Street Journal poll today, shows that among independent voters, I think it's fewer than 25% of independent voters have positive feelings about the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
Interesting. Now to Jason, who's in New Braunfels, Texas. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Hi.
Listen, if I know the white wine sipping, sob driving NPR liberals are worried today. You heard the guy in Newton. He said he was scared. Now you're talking to a Texan who was never scared, not a year ago, not after the election results. If you want to look for a silver lining, the good news is the defeat of Martha Coakley is that Texas, who had we been given no choice in the matter about taking government health care, you might have legitimately heard serious political figures in this state talk about seceding from the union. Even if only symbolically, it would have made the point, which nobody on your panel can deny, the United States needs Texas a lot more than Texas needs the United States right now.
Boy, that's the first time I've heard that one, Peter Baker.
Well, you know, Texas is actually an interesting case. There is a war going on there in between the governor, Rick Perry, who in fact did talk about secession at one point, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who's challenging him in a Republican primary. And that's a very interesting contest that gets at Peter Walson's point about the Republicans trying to figure out who they are. You know, what does this race that we've just seen last night mean for what the Republican profile would be come the fall?
Be careful what you wish for, Chris.
You know, Peter Baker and I were joking about this off camera, but off air. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that a person who is extremely happy about last night's election result is Governor Rick Perry. He is someone who has, more so than almost any other elected official, identified with sort of the grassroots Republican movement in the country that clearly stepped up. In the Massachusetts election, Scott Brown was raising millions of dollars in the last week of the campaign online, something we haven't heard about a Republican, frankly, ever doing. These are Rick Perry's people. His talk of secession, notwithstanding, if he does win against Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the primary is March 2nd, as Peter Baker mentioned, you know, I think you will start to see Rick Perry emerge more as a figure of the angry right and to Peter Walson's point, the angry middle in many ways.
Peter.
Just to build on Chris's point again and Peter's point about Texas, there was a lot made after 2008 about Barack Obama's brilliant presidential campaign, how they harnessed the power of the internet, raised all of this money, built this massive grassroots neighborhood network. The president then tried to take that network and turn it into something that would make policy, that would help pressure lawmakers, build public support for policy around the country, this kind of much vaunted network. By the way, they went big time into Massachusetts in the final week and didn't seem to make a difference. There's been other signs that that network hasn't had much of an effect in helping to push policy, like healthcare. However, now we see the grassroots power on the right. It's just easier to build a grassroots campaign when you're on the outs, when you're upset, when you're angry, when you feel put upon. And when you're the establishment, it's just hard to build the grassroots network. Maybe what we're seeing is that the brilliance of the Barack Obama campaign in 2008, and it was very well run, but now that with that anger transferred to somewhere else, we'll just see that happening on the right. And politics is changing naturally.
Peter Baker, just to come back for a moment to a cover story you wrote for the New York Times Magazine, you said that President Obama has not made big changes to the way policies of the previous administration were handled, especially when it comes to the threat of terrorism. Everybody's saying, oh, he's moved so fast, and yet here he's kind of sticking to what was.
Terrorism is a really interesting case study, and it does connect to what we've been talking about all along, because, in fact, President Obama did adopt a lot of what President Bush had left him in terms of counterterrorism policy. He has moderated to some extent. He has made some decisions that actually are substantial changes, but by and large, he's kept a lot of what President Bush was doing, drone strikes in Pakistani areas, military commissions, rendition, preventive detention with no trials, and so forth. So, you know, but the language is different. The tone is different. The rhetoric is different. And that has been what has been the subject of great debate lately in Massachusetts with Scott Brown talking about terrorism in the post-Christmas Day plot era, and Vice President Cheney and so forth. And I think that will be a big issue coming into this fall. Is President Obama leading us in a war on terror, a phrase he doesn't like to use? He prefers to use the phrase war on al-Qaeda. Does he properly understand that we're at war? And the flip side is, on the left, he's under attack for not doing more to moderate some of what they saw as a civil liberties infringements of the Bush era.
And how did Scott Brown talk about terror or the war against al-Qaeda during the campaign, Chris?
You know, this is one where I may be willing to buy the White House line that Massachusetts is unique on this specific issue. And the reason is because Martha Coakley, Peter Wilson mentioned her poor campaign, and there's any number of examples of it. But one of the big ones is her assertion in a debate that was watched by lots of people in Massachusetts, that there was no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That
was that worse than calling somebody a Yankee?
It probably was not worse in the sports obsessed culture of Massachusetts, not knowing that Curt Schilling, or seeming to not know that Curt Schilling was a legendary Red Sox pitcher and not likely a Yankee fan, probably is bigger. But in relation to this issue, she handed in the al-Qaeda in Afghanistan comment, she handed Scott Brown a way in which to say, this is someone who fundamentally doesn't get it. Now, Republicans launched that attack against President Obama, but as Peter detailed in his piece, which if folks listening haven't read, they should, because it's a remarkable look into how the president thinks broadly, not just about terrorism. But as Peter detailed, it's hard to attack President Obama on the charge that he doesn't take this seriously. Now, you could disagree with the way in which he tonally talks about it, but the idea that he doesn't believe that there's a war on terror, I don't think that will sell against him. I think Coakley gave Scott Brown a way in which to paint her as hopelessly out of touch on the issue.
To connect, Diane, the politics of terrorism and national security to health care, this is part of the Obama problem right now. He has no natural base of constituency on any of these issues. There's nobody, because the liberal base is upset about the direction of health care. The liberal base is upset about the direction of national security. The conservatives are attacking him on both of those issues quite successfully in a political context now. George W. Bush, going into his reelection campaign, always had the conservative base, and they did a great job of keeping the conservative base unified. Barack Obama right now doesn't have that natural base of constituency. He has nobody out there really going to bat for him and fighting for him, nobody that is helping him with this. He's in some ways going it alone, and that seems like an untenable position in American politics today.
Let's go now to East Lansing, Michigan. Conrad, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I need a clarification on both procedure and the politics of the current situation. Senator-elect Brown's rise to power, I guess, means that the Democrats will lose cloture votes in the Senate. But what's the downside of the Democrats actually forcing Republicans to filibuster the health care bill if that's their actual intent?
Well, you mean to actually get up there and talk all
endlessly,
night and so forth, right?
Yeah,
that's it's funny. That has not been the practice in a number of years. It goes back, you know, we have this image from, Jimmy Stewart and in the movies in the old days of having to actually take the floor for hours and hours reading cookbooks and anything else you can. That has not been the practice for years. The senators on both sides of the aisle have in modern times, simply use the threat of a filibuster as enough to invoke cloture. And neither side seems all that interested in forcing the old style of doing it, because while the Democrats are unhappy about the filibuster rule right now, they know someday they might need it as a minority themselves. They use it pretty effectively against George Bush.
And again, context matters. The politics that happen in Massachusetts matter in the U.S. Senate. Excuse me. The idea of changing the rules now, and there has been talk of doing so earlier in the healthcare debate. The idea of doing so now, in the wake of what you could argue is the largest upset in modern Senate political history, I just don't think is going to go down. As Peter Baker said, this is not a body that adopts change quickly or easily. And the idea that they would do it in the wake of such a sort of political upheaval, I think it's just not politically practical.
And to Wichita, Kansas, Idika, you're on the air.
Yes, Diane, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, as a Republican, I find it very interesting. There is nothing shocking about Scott Brown winning the election in Massachusetts. First of all, Democrats have no steady hold on politics. You see, it's not a matter of the policies of Obama or the policies of we Republicans. It's a matter of leadership. I felt that the base of the Democratic Party always come out during the presidential election. And we Republicans know that weakness, that during other elections, Democrats do not come out. For us Republicans, every territory is a matter of life and death, and we fight for it. Democrats are not ready to fight for anything.
Peter Baker.
Well, I mean, this is going to feed into a lot of that kind of, you know, sentiment out there, as the caller talked about, and it's going to feed into a lot of questions about, you know, who's willing to fight and what do you fight for? What do you stand for? What are your identities? And it's so fascinating how we're in this position just a year after you would have had a very different. And it reminds us, by the way, to be humble about what we think we now know. A year from now, the picture may look very different again. I've now covered 3 White Houses, and I've heard each one of them talk after an election about how this is a paradigm shift, and this may be the beginning of realignment. The Clinton people talked about that after 1996.
Sure.
The Bush did after 2004, and the Obama people did a year ago.
And now to Tallahassee, Florida. Tom, you're on the air.
Hey, well, I was slightly amused by the New York Times appraisal that what this proves is that Obama should have rammed through health care earlier. It's like, boy, they sure don't get it. If you look back over the election, you would have seen that Obama had been talking about health care all leading up to this election, and he wasn't getting anywhere. The polls were really close. What made that election for Obama, and when the polls dramatically changed, was when the financial crisis hit. And yet, when he got into office, what did he do to get the jobs and turn the economy around? That seems to be what's been put on the back burner for all this.
Thanks, Tom. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Peter Baker.
Well, actually, I don't disagree with what the caller just said. I think actually those two thoughts are married. It's the fact that you said that my comment about taking so long in healthcare missed the point. It actually is your point. It's that they have focused so much on healthcare, and that has been the obsession of Congress and the White House for so long that they were not perceived as doing anything about the economy broadly.
Peter Walston.
No, that I completely agree with Peter's point on that. Also, that the issue of getting health care done more quickly, the point there is that, right, the time wouldn't have been spent on it. They would have gotten it done, and now they could be trying to sell it to the American public and try to sell the virtues of it, as the Democrats see it, rather than defending it and talking constantly about the process of
making it. So you're saying that the approach was wrong to begin with, to put this much emphasis on one healthcare problem.
You know, I think that what you saw was the Obama administration believing that this was something that he knew was going to be an extremely heavy lift, and that in order to do so, he needed to move as quickly as possible after winning a mandate election. I don't think anyone could disagree with 365 electoral votes in our current political climate being a pretty strong mandate, move to do this. What they were doing, I think they were haunted, as almost every administration is, by the previous administrations. Bill Clinton kept the healthcare process, his attempt to overhaul healthcare, very private, did not share details with Congress. I think the Obama administration went too far in the other direction, essentially leaving it up to Congress. What you saw is what Congress does. Lots of committees, lots of people, lots of bills, lots of disagreement, and
sausage.
Lots of time.
Sausage.
And sausage making is bad politics. People do not like to see – you don't like to see the puppeteer's hands, Diane. You like to see the puppet show.
So how does the still democratically controlled Congress move forward? Peter.
They'd have no idea.
Neither do we.
They're debating that as we speak. It's very much a crapshoot at this point. I think that they are they're as I think Chris and Peter both mentioned, they're sort of a bravado about how they're not going to let go of their issues. But the fact of the matter is, they have to rethink their approach. And that this has been a year. 2009 was a year where I think we saw more party line votes on big moments than we've seen in a long time, in which there were no Republicans or very few Republicans on any of the big issues. That obviously is not a sustainable position anymore. And the Democrats can say it's all the Republicans' fault, and maybe the Republicans say it's all the Democrats' fault. Whatever. In the end, if any governing is going to happen between now and Election Day, there's going to have to be some sort of change in attitude.
Let's hope that there's some kind of change. The country has to move forward. We cannot keep on this way. Peter Baker of the New York Times, Chris Saliza of WashingtonPost.com, Peter Walston of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.